Could I have your attention, please? We're going to go ahead and get started with tonight's program. Welcome to the biennial Cal Poly Sustainability Convocation. My name is Dave Wehner. I'm Dean of the College of Agriculture, and Dean Tom Jones will introduce the speaker in just a few minutes. The past practice on this convocation is to have the dean that's associated with an area similar to what the speaker has interest in to speak a little bit about what's going on in their particular college in relationship to sustainability and environmental stewardship. So I want to tell you a few things about the College of Agriculture quickly. As many of you know, the College of Agriculture has responsibility for about 9,000 acres of land. That is 6,000 acres on the campus core and another 3,000 acres at Swanton Pacific Ranch, which is just north of Santa Cruz. As a college, we have six strategic vision themes. One of those strategic vision themes is our college is a model for resource management and environmental stewardship. So we all have a commitment to this, starting with our vision. While we have a lot of work to get done, I can report on some of the activities that my dedicated faculty, staff, and students who are passionate about sustainability and environmental stewardship, those things that they've accomplished over the last few years. These activities range from a broad range of things from restoration and stabilization of areas surrounding Brazilira Creek, which is on campus, to conducting research and developing programs aimed at improving grazing practices to reduce erosion and improve water quality in Choro Creek and the Morro Bay watersheds. And you might be interested to know, in the Morro Bay watershed, 80% of the land that feeds into that watershed is actually grazing land. So our work has helped maintain or develop a better water quality, less erosion from that area. In that project, we worked with the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, the State Department of Fish and Game, and the National Fish and Wildlife Service. We've also done vegetative restoration work with Caltrans, so some of your roadsides have influence from Cal Poly doing work on vegetative stabilization of those areas. We're working with the National Estuary Program to exchange some land that we have responsibility for in order to create a riparian filter adjacent to Walters Creek. We've established native vegetation in our own vineyards and our new avocado orchard in order to maintain soil stabilization and avoid erosion. So our work has involved state, local, regional, and national agencies working with us. Our Irrigation Training and Research Center has worked through the state and region and internationally to develop more efficient water management systems. Recently, they received the 2005 Commissioner's Water Conservation Award for the Mid-Pacific region from the Bureau of Reclamation. This award is given to individuals or entities that have demonstrated significant accomplishments in improving water use efficiency. On another front, we offer produce to the community that has been grown by our students on our organic farm. This is done through a community-supported agriculture project. The farm is certified by the California Certified Organic Farmers. We also have natural beef products, which are grass-fed for sale in our meats lab. And we offer classes such as Agriculture 450, Applied Holistic Management, and Plant Protection Science 441, Biological Control for Pest Management. We have a Sustainable Agriculture Resource Consortium, which is a group of faculty working on sustainability issues and instructional activities, and they also work with industry and the community. That group has received a major grant from the Columbia Foundation to support the development of that consortium. Our college forest at Swanton Pacific Ranch has been designated as a sustainable forest by the International Forest Stewardship Council. It's important to realize, though, that we still have the opportunity for our students to be involved in timber harvests on this forest, but we have it set up so it is a sustainable forest, so the students get access and an understanding of commercial timber management practices in a sustainable forest. We also offer an environmental protection and management major and an earth science major. finally, in recognition of the programs related to the environment and the true diversity of all the programs offered in the College of Agriculture, we're going to expand the name of the college, effective this fall, to become the College of Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Sciences. I hope you agree with me that our college has demonstrated worthy efforts to understand, educate, and demonstrate sustainability and environmental stewardship. I'll turn it over to Dr. Tom Jones.
Well, I wanted to give you all a hearty welcome. I'm actually up here pleased and proud to say that this is really the third in a series of wonderful convocations instituted 4 years ago by the faculty across all the disciplines at Cal Poly, who were passionately interested in how we link up, talk about, and engage not just one another, but world leaders, significant leaders in their fields in the issue of sustainability. We bring them to our campus, we take them on tours, we ask them to share their global perspective of the challenges we face. And being a polytechnic, we ask them, what can we do about it? And so we gather every couple of years, and with the support of President Baker and with the funding from the Provost Office, we put out a search, who is that thinker? Who can we bring this year? How can they engage us? And Dr. Peter Raven, name rose to the top, an internationally renowned expert, and I'll read his bio, and I could spend the whole evening just doing that, accomplished, engaged, energetic. I've had a chance to meet him, and his equally energetic and wonderful wife, Dr. Patricia Raven, have come to us from Missouri, and share with us a passion and love for the landscape. And I want to do something unusual, because I look at this crowd and I marvel that we got 1,000 students on a Friday night and faculty here to come to a gymnasium to hear a terrific speaker. How many of you are not in the College of Agriculture? What does that say about how much this issue crosses our boundaries? I'm thrilled by that. And as you came in, you saw some slides, and they were the slides of this extraordinary landscape we share and have a passion for. And this landscape is one where you have a dense urban campus surrounded by some of the most precious natural environment and productive ag land in the world. And that's why I snuck in, by the way, pictures of the solar decathlon. You must have wondered, now what is that funny building under construction that later appears on the Washington Mall? Students from several of the colleges of engineering and architecture built that wonderful award-winning decathlon, totally powered by solar energy. And where did they build it? On ag land. That was the land available to help us launch the decathlon. We who are in the design and engineering professions are so proud to be at an institution that has a preeminent agricultural college. This is unique. And I think Dr. Raven is a person who brings people together across disciplines, across nations and across fields. He's been successful in his native Missouri of shepherding one of the oldest, I think the oldest, if I'm correct, botanical garden in our country into the new era while maintaining scholarship and engagement across the planet. Now, when we presented Dr. Baker with our recommendation, he said, well, of course I know Peter. Did you know we served together on the Board of Governors of the National Science Foundation? So what a small world it is. And as a native Californian who grew up here, he returns here to grace us with his presence. So I want to extend a warm welcome to Peter. I'm going to read a few. Modestly, I can't possibly cover the breadth and depth of his profession, but I'm going to read some remarks. I also want you to know this is a collective effort. It's because of you faculty and you students and President Baker, who signed the Talwar Declaration and is leading Cal Poly to be visibly engaged about these issues, that we have this series, that we bring these great speakers. And a group of faculty at the Academic Senate created, and the President has appointed some members to the Sustainability Committee. And I want to particularly acknowledge two faculty who really worked to put a wonderful tour together for Dr. Raven. And again, in two different departments, Matt Ritter, I wanted to acknowledge Matt, and also Stephen Marks. And there were dozens of other people who worked on this. And Dr. Raven and Dr. Patricia Raven had a wonderful time looking at our campus today. So the other important thing to remember, as you hear his remarks today, he's one of us. He was born here. He spent the last several hours touring our campus. And he's hardly a person that is short on opinions. Let me read a few remarks about Dr. Raven. I think it's very important to understand that he was picked by Time Magazine as a hero for the planet. Let's start with that acknowledgement. But he is also the director of the Missouri Botanical Garden. He's a leading world-renowned botanist and advocate of conservation and biodiversity, and he's going to address us with those remarks tonight. He's a researcher. He's the chairman of the National Geographic Society's Committee for Research and Exploration. He's very engaged as a member, past president, and chairman of the board of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He has been the recipient of numerous prizes and awards, international prizes for biology from the government of Japan, and several other international awards. So he's traveling the globe and bringing back to us that perspective. He served for 12 years as Home Secretary of the National Academy of Science. He is a member of the Academics of Science in the following countries: Argentina, Brazil, China, Denmark, India, Italy, Mexico, Russia, Sweden, the UK. He was first chair of the U.S. Civilian Research and Development Foundation, which was a government-established organization that funds joint research with the independent countries of the former Soviet Union. So here's a gentleman that clearly is engaged in the world. He's written numerous books and publications. He's not just traveled widely and shared this incredible wealth of knowledge and perspective. He's a scholar, written both popular and scientific books, and he comes from California, received his PhD from the University of California, Los Angeles in 1960 after completing his undergraduate work at the University of California, Berkeley. A native son, we welcome him here and back, Dr. Peter Raven.
There's no way that I can speak to you tonight. I paid for this microphone.
Oh.
Now they're all working now. Now I'm going to blast you. No. Gee, it's amazing to be out here and see the hills looking such a beautiful green, but I'm a native, so I know it's a trick. Herb Kane, the famous columnist in the San Francisco Chronicle, once said that a true Californian is one who knows that the hills are naturally a golden color attractive, which disappears briefly in winter, giving rise to a greenish scum that soon fades. I also know that there's no such thing as a good year for cattle in California, because if the rains come and you get a lot of growth, then you say, oh my Lord, think of the fires this summer, and if they don't come, instead, the cattle are going to starve. It's terrible. It's wonderful to be here at this beautiful campus at such a beautiful time of year. I can very well remember the first time I came to San Luis Obispo in 1951 at the age of 15. And I was collecting plants up in the Bay Area at that time, and I was totally carried away by the wonder and the beauty of all the plants here and the way that they gave me such an introduction at the closest possible range to the plants of Southern California. If you're a Northern Californian, you identify things as you go south, and by the time you get down here, they look like what you think of as a Southern California flora, pretty much by and large. But of course, here, as everywhere else in the coast ranges, it's the mixture of northern and southern elements growing together that make it all so incredibly exciting biologically. I should say also about the little matter of being a third generation graduate of Berkeley and a PhD from UCLA, and then I taught at Stanford for 9 years. Once I was introduced at the University of Wisconsin, and when I was teaching at Stanford, and the one who was introducing me said, "This man seems to have gotten degrees from Berkeley and UCLA, and now he's teaching at Stanford. No one combines those schools in their biography." And I said, "Oh yes, those are three of the four schools that hate USC the most." Now, what I want to talk about today, you may think as I go along, is preaching to the choir, but you may all be converted. If you're not converted, then this is your lucky day. But if you are converted, then consider yourself the choir and consider that I'm preaching to you. And believe me, people do preach to choirs. And the reason that they do is they want the people that they're preaching to be animated and activated and raised to higher levels of enthusiasm and understanding for the things that are being preached about. And in this campus here, with its fantastic endowment of natural scenes, agricultural, modified, beautiful natural scenes, human construction, a wonderful community of students and scholars here in one of the most beautiful areas in the world, you have both the setting and the inspiration to provide a real example in the area of sustainability. Sustainability, which I'll talk about as I go along, really means how are we going to overcome what we've come to believe is natural, the inordinate consumption of all the world's natural resources that dates back really to the Industrial Revolution and has put together the wonderful world in which we find ourselves with good control of diseases, rapid transportation, communication throughout the whole world. And how are we going to make that last? Believe me, and this is what I'll attempt to demonstrate for you and what you undoubtedly know explicitly or implicitly, believe me, if we want the party to last or anything like the party that we're enjoying to last, we have to take some new steps. We have to reach deeper levels of understanding, practice, example, and especially perhaps caring for one another. Much of what I have to say will center on biological diversity or biodiversity, the beautiful array of organisms that populate this planet Earth with us, on which we depend in so many ways, alone and in combination, and from which we will attempt to weave the strands that will allow us to attain the elusive condition of sustainability. And I say condition rather than goal, because sustainability is a way of thinking and a way of living that must, if we're to be successful, pervade every single part of our lives. The interactions between organisms that control the flow of energy through the ecosystems that in turn support the planet Earth are intricate, and the vast majority of them very poorly understood. And we, living in a fortunate country like the United States, may think intuitively that life will always go on as it is now. There are other parts of the world that are less fortunate than we are, but as we all gain understanding of the way the world functions together, we will find ways to go forward into a better future. That would be a very good idea, because we live in a world in which half the population lives on less than $2 a day. 1 in 8 people is literally starving in terms of their caloric intake, and half the world's people do not get enough of at least one essential nutrient. So You might say half the people in the world are malnourished, taking that into the definition. That's not the kind of a world that we're accustomed to seeing around us, but it's certainly the kind of world that really exists. It's very common in the United States for us to fall back on the mantra, it all depends on population. Population is the only important thing, and it's the only important problem that we have. But if we really examine what we mean by that, I'm afraid that what we will often mean by that is that people in other countries, having large numbers of people, are causing themselves to be starving, and that's really their fault, and if they could only be more discriminating about it, everything would be okay. There's also, depending on what your viewpoint is, often a strain of anti-Catholicism mixed into it, as if the Pope goes around saying, have children, have children, have children. In fact, what the Pope does go around saying, just as a footnote, is it's immoral for people to have more children than they can support properly. Population is very important, but consider that the average person in the United States lives at about 30 to 40 times the level that the average person in rural Brazil or rural Indonesia lives, and then calculate that the population of the United States has grown from 150 million in 1950 to just under 300 million today. And then multiply the 150 million by 30 or 40, and we come up to a number in terms of impact. We come up to a number in terms of impact that's frighteningly close to the entire population of the third world, 4.3 billion people. Because it's not only population. Obviously, population is fundamental. The more people there are consuming, the more is being consumed. But the next question is, how much are the individual people consuming? How much are we consuming? And if we begin to look at that part of the equation well, then we can begin to see that there are many things that we could do about it in a country like the United States to preserve resources in creative ways, and particularly appropriate to Cal Poly, we can improve the technologies that we use, which themselves have an alarmingly tough impact on the environment throughout the world. So remember, as we go through the remarks that I'm going to be making today, that it's not just population. If anybody gets up at the end and says, you didn't say enough about population, which is really fundamentally the only problem, which is what it usually is, we're going to fine them $50 and give the money to the Student Sustainability Consortium. So population, this scene of Mexico City just provides a visual example of what it means to have very large numbers of people, regardless of how they're living and regardless of the technology. You have both assets in people living in groups and difficulties in people living in groups this large. And then let's look at affluence. These are ranchettes in Colorado, but they might as well be ranchettes in California. Since the zoning is basically set by water availability in California, everyone thinks it's lovely to have a little ranchette and goes out a little house there with 3 or 4 acres, which is all you can do with the zoning. Then you may have a horse in the back and the rest may be a whole bunch of weeds. And isn't that great? But actually, one could not think of a better or more effective way to waste resources or to consume more of the world's resources than to live in this kind of lifestyle. And it's wonderful that the School of Architecture here is so committed to ingenious ways to overcoming the kind of difficulties presented by this image, because those are precisely the things that we need to do in a world where over 50% of the people where people are moving into cities, where rural areas are being abandoned, where people are pushing out to suburbs, and all of those things are going on simultaneously. And then we have the uses of technology. This is a scene in Cairo, and it shows you what technology, from plants, from cooking with inappropriate fuels, with driving too many automobiles and all can add up to. Los Angeles used to look like this and unfortunately is drifting back a little bit in this direction at the present time. I always enjoyed David Letterman's comment about Los Angeles, where he said, "Autumn is my favorite time of the year in Los Angeles. It's when the birds change colors and fall out of the trees." Now, the problem on a scale in which we see it today really began with the development of crop agriculture at the eastern end of the Mediterranean basin in what's called the Fertile Crescent about 10,500 years ago. And if the problem really began with the invention of agriculture, then let's hope that a great agriculturally oriented institution like Cal Poly can help to unravel that problem, even with the numbers of people that we have at the world at the present time, and set us back on a sustainable course. Now, human beings have been on Earth for about 2 million years, and it wasn't until 10,500 years ago that they developed agriculture. In other words, about just over 400 human generations ago, after 8,000 earlier generations. Before that time, people were living in scattered bands, sometimes permanent settlements in places where there were unusually rich supplies of food, and then going out and harvesting in nature the kinds of crops and the kinds of domestic animals that they later brought into cultivation and domestication and provided a sustainable food supply on the basis of which human populations could begin to grow. But consider that 400 generations ago, the entire human population of the world is estimated at about 3 to 4 million people. In other words, a small fraction of the number of people, a tenth of the number of more or less of the number of people that live in California at the present time. And that constituted the entire population of Eurasia, Africa, Australia, North and South America put together. Obviously, if there were 3 or 4 million people in the world, their impact was far, far less than it's become over the past 400 generations. As those populations grew, what we consider civilization developed as specialized professions began to develop in those villages, towns, cities, and city-states that have come along with the growth in population. And so remember that what we consider civilization, and this goes back to what I began with, what we consider civilization depends on a surging growth, a large number of people, and a great deal of specialization. Written languages first appear about 5,500 years ago, about half the time from the development of crop agriculture to the present, independently in a couple of centers. And of course, once they appeared, then the intensity of civilization and its complexity began to be deepened. Now look here, in about 1790, when the Reverend Thomas Malthus was saying that human population growth was so rapid that it would soon outstrip our ability to feed itself, he certainly had no idea of how rapidly it would grow. But he also paid, as it turns out, insufficient attention to the fruits of the Industrial Revolution, which had begun with the invention of the steam engine, and which made it possible to bring into cultivation much more extensive areas than had been available for farm and grazing land earlier. And as you can see on this chart, the world population passes 1 billion people in the early 19th century, gets to 2 billion people in about 1930, goes on to about 2.5 billion people in 1950, and now, early in the 21st century, we have about 6.5 billion people in the world. So in about 50 years, in about half a century, the world population has gone from 2.5 billion people to 6.5 billion people. There are various estimates on what might happen in the future, but it seems very likely that at least 2 billion additional people will be added to the world population before it reaches stability. And I should say that the most rapid growth in population from a percentage point of view was about 1971, and then it began to slow down as more women were empowered, as people became more affluent in certain parts of the world and for various reasons. And the peak in numbers of individuals added to the world population was in the early 1990s. Of course, there was an overshoot of about 20 years there because the base was larger, even though the percentage per year was declining. Since 1950, we've lost about 20% of the world's topsoil. We've lost about 20% of our agricultural land to desertification, salinization, often associated with over-irrigation, sometimes associated with drawing out too much groundwater. We've lost more than a third of the forests that were around in 1950. We've increased carbon dioxide, the major gas in the atmosphere that's driven by human beings, by about a sixth. And we've lost 6 to 8% of the stratospheric ozone layer, which means that in latitudes like this, the incidence of malignant skin cancer has gone up over 20% since 1950. What these measurements and other measurements of this kind mean is that the world is not being managed sustainably. Obviously, we can't lose all of our agricultural land. We can't lose all of our topsoil. We can't increase carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to the point where we're all boiling. So we will reach sustainability at some point. We have to. But I think the choice that we have to make is, will it be a soft landing or will it be a hard landing? Are we going to be clever enough to be limiting population, to be figuring out better and less wasteful ways to consume? Will we be finding better technologies to use so that we can find this sustainable condition when the world is still rich and diverse and beautiful and wonderful like the world that we have now? Or will we need to exploit that world and the things that it produces down to the very end before we necessarily reach sustainability at a very much lower level? The choice is really ours. These are the sorts of things that have come to characterize very widely the last 50 years. Another way of summarizing what's going on is by pointing out that we are, at the present time, estimated to be consuming directly, wasting, as for example, by burning up forests, or diverting, as by building golf courses, about half of the world's total net photosynthetic productivity on land. We human beings, one of an estimated 10 million species on Earth, and I'll go into those estimates more in a minute, are using about half of the total biological productivity that can support us. And at the same time, over 50% of the sustainable supplies of fresh water in the world. And remember that that's in a world, and the lack of sustainability that I just outlined is in a world where about half the people are malnourished and living in extreme poverty, and about an eighth of the people in the world are starving, and where we're looking at adding another 2 billion people in the next several decades. Indira Gandhi, at the Stockholm Conference on the Environment in 1972, was the first person to generalize concerns about the world environment to an international scope. Before that, in the United States, for example, where we reached heights of environmentalism that I'll talk about in the 60s and early 70s, those were largely domestic. But Indira Gandhi pointed out that the inherent conflict is not between conservation on the one hand and development on the other hand, but between environment, something we'd call sustainable environment now, and the reckless exploitation of man and the earth in the name of efficiency. Until we begin to address succinctly the fact that so many people in the world are living like this Tibetan girl gathering firewood, where she and her mother and her brothers will spend basically all their time walking 20 miles, 15 or 20 miles in each direction each day to get firewood, to get water, and to prepare food in smoky, carcinogenic dwellings. Until we begin to look squarely at the plight of people like her and understand what that means to the world, which is at the end of the day our world, we will be incapable of really making things any better. A very cogent question about the whole situation is, can all nations achieve the standards of prosperity in the developed countries, that should say, using available technologies? When Gandhi was visiting England in 1947 on the eve of the independence of India, a British reporter asked him whether India would achieve standards of living like England now that it was going to be independent. And he said, when I look at the map, half of it is in the British Empire. The produce of all of those countries come together to support the prosperity of England, and India, being a much larger country in population with no empire, can scarcely achieve the same thing. If you read the report of the World Condition on the World Commission on the Environment and Development, the Brundtland report, which came out in 1987 and was the first report that really stressed the need for sustainability, you get a general rosy picture that if all the countries in the world simply cooperate, they can all just develop forward to a very fine new condition. I recommend the website globalfootprint.org, which is a think tank now in Oakland, California, that provides the basis for what I'm about to demonstrate. And they have estimated, on the basis of a number of articulated measurements, that to support everyone at the current standard of living and population, in other words, how much of the world's productivity are we using on a continuing basis, we're using about 120% of what the world produces. And that's a very clear definition of a lack of sustainability. They estimate that this has risen from about 70% of everything that the world produces in the year 1970. And then, of course, we would want to ask, how much would it take to support everyone if the population doubled, because we're going somewhere in that direction, with amounts, proportions of misery and all the other problems that we've outlined about they are now. And, of course, it's 2.4. And then here's the question. If we use levels of consumption that, like those that we have in the United States and in Western Europe, and we want to raise everyone in the current world population to the standard of developed countries, it would take 3 copies of the planet Earth to do that. And that is a clear indication that we've got to both not only pay attention to population, but also to levels of consumption and to the development of new technologies which will allow us to live on what is the only planet that we really have available sustainably, or face a continuing erosion of everything that we find important. And of course, if they both increase, then you get to really ridiculous numbers, not that we have access to even 1/5 of another planet to spread into. Once, when I was at Stanford, we figured out about sending people to other planets, and we figured out that if you took the entire world gross economic product for a year, and if You took the nearest star that was likely to have inhabitable planets. You could export 12 people a year. It didn't seem like a very good deal. I mean, environmentalists are kind of loony sometimes when it comes to economic calculations, but even we could see that that was not good economics. Now I'd like to make some remarks about biodiversity. The species of plants, animals, fungi, and microorganisms are essential for our lives, and we hope to use them very extensively in building global sustainability, and yet we're driving them to extinction at an unprecedented rate. So what could we do about reversing it? Well, first we have to get some idea of what we use them for, and of course all of our food comes directly or indirectly from plants. About 90% from just over 100 kinds of plants, and about 60% from three: wheat, corn, rice. The genetic diversity of those plants is what we need to use to protect them from pandemic diseases. Believe me, if we were all like the cornfields in the Midwest in terms of our genetic uniformity, an avian flu was on the horizon, not for us, but for corn. Can you imagine how rapidly it would spread through the whole population? The thing that gives us a relative chance of survival as human beings is precisely our genetic diversity, and that's exactly what we need for our crops. In addition to that, about two-thirds of the people in the world use plants directly as their source of medicine. And even for those of us who live in industrialized countries and go to drugstores for most of our medicines, about a quarter of the medicines we use come from plants or came from plants originally. And many of the rest, including the 4,000 kinds of antibiotics that have been patented since the end of World War II, come from natural sources also. Our relationship to plants is intimate, and of course we use them as building materials and as weaving materials and for many other aspects of supporting our lives. And in addition, we need to note in a discussion like this that we really began the age of molecular biology, probably you could say most logically in the 1960s, when people began to understand for the first time the genetic code and could see how the double helical model postulated 10 years earlier could work. But yet, if we want to understand scientifically or use any of that genetic information, which is now so richly being presented in comparative studies of genomes of organisms of all kinds being done at an accelerating rate and at a lower and lower cost, then we do need the organisms to be able to make those comparisons and use that information for our own benefit. In addition to the individual properties of organisms, we have ecosystem services by virtue of which the organisms, for example, pollinate our crops free of charge, or by virtue of which birds come out of communities and eat harmful insects, by virtue of which watersheds are protected, landslides are prevented, local climates are determined, topsoil is protected, and many other kinds whose value goes up into the trillions of dollars per year. And of course, calculating their collective value is a little silly because we didn't have ecosystem services, we'd all be dead, so there wouldn't be anything to do with the calculations. The relationship between people and plants, these women are carrying bananas on in a ceremony in Honduras. The relationship between people and plants, between people and nature, is an intense one, and we can be very sure that after 8,000 years of honing our skills and 8,000 generations of honing our skills and developing our languages in an intimate association with biological diversity, that it has a lot to do with the structure of our communication and with our thoughts and with our comfort in dealing with the natural world, aside from being an endless source of spiritual refreshment and beauty that has delighted and inspired people through the years. leaving out bacteria, which is what the words in the blue block mean there, because we can't estimate numbers of bacteria effectively. There's something like 10 million kinds of organisms in the world, we estimate by comparing with well-known groups, but of those, only about 1.6 million or about one-sixth of them have actually been identified and named, and in many cases, in the vast majority of even the ones that have been named, we don't really know anything about them except there may be one specimen somewhere. To give you one example, of all the known species of orchids that have been named in Latin America, over half of them, which is something like 8,000 species, are known from three or fewer specimens. And that's sort of typical. Often all you know is that there's a body of one lying in the bottom of a bottle of alcohol in some museum somewhere. So even putting a name on it doesn't really tell you anything very worthwhile. If we cut down or burn tropical forests, about 19 out of 20 of the species that we're destroying will never have been named, will never have been seen or appreciated by anybody before they die. Who knows what riches lie out there, riches for the spirit, riches for the laboratory, riches for commerce, riches in terms of their combinations with other organisms that make this world bountiful and healthy, still exist. We can estimate extinction rates by comparing the rate in the geological record using as a reference point animals that have hard body parts like mollusks and vertebrates, about 10 per year, we would estimate. For the last 400 years, we've had enough written material to estimate directly species that people saw disappearing. Now we have several thousands disappearing per year, and very soon we'll have tens of thousands disappearing per year throughout the world. And do remember that the vast majority of those, and these are all reasoned by comparison with well-known groups that we can monitor like birds or butterflies, the majority of them, the great majority of them, will never have been seen. This would lead to the extinction of about two-thirds of all the kinds of organisms in the world by the end of this century, which is an extinction event that would parallel that, at the end of the Cretaceous period when the dinosaurs finally disappeared. Mammals came into the ascendancy, and the whole character of life changed over the course of about 10 million years before earlier evolutionary patterns were regained. We can get to an extinction rate like that simply by looking at loss of habitat. For example, tropical moist forests, rainforests, cloud forests, and allied formations are estimated to contain about half of the kinds of organisms on Earth, and yet they're estimated to have been reduced to about 5% of their current extent, of their original extent, rather, by the middle of this century. And since the relationship between species and area is a logarithmic one, that alone would account for worldwide would account for a loss of about two-thirds of all the species on Earth. But there are three other important factors that are also operating. One, alien invasive species. One can't even imagine what the grasslands on the Cal Poly campus would have looked like or what kind of vegetation would have been there when Father Serra and his followers reached San Luis Obispo on their way north in California. We do know for sure that they brought burr clover and oats and lots of the other things that make up the grasslands with them, because people have analyzed the bricks in the missions and they find these European weeds already there. But the change has been so profound that it's impossible to get a clear idea or to get a consensus view on what kind of vegetation was there before. Zebra mussels, as of 2000, over several decades, have spread over all the rivers in the United States. Many kinds of plants grow in such abundance, alien plants grow in such abundance, that they choke out the natives completely, like the grassland species I just mentioned. Then there's selective gathering, bushmeat harvesting in Africa. European and other fishing boats come down the west coast of Africa in such numbers that they're basically depleting the fishing that the natives in West Africa have traditionally done, so they turn to bush meat for their meat, and in the process are driving many of the animals to the edge of and perhaps eventually over the edge of extinction. And of course the gathering of plants for dietary supplements and drugs and so forth throughout the world has a similar effect on plant species. And you'll notice that both the spread of aliens and the harvesting of species can affect protected areas as well as unprotected areas. And then there's global warming, the little matter of global warming. You can see there average temperatures from the year 1000 to the year 1900 remained about the same. Taking 0 degrees Celsius as kind of an index, you can see that the projections and the lines coming up on the right are a number of different computer models. The projections for the end of this century range from about 1.5 degrees Celsius, 1.5 or 2 degrees Celsius, to about 5.5 degrees Celsius, with a mean around 3, let's say. That kind of a difference in temperature, in average temperature, will have profound effects on biological organisms during the course of this century. For example, in the lower 48 states, obviously including the Sierra Nevada and Cascade Peaks and mountains of Southern California, all of the alpine and subalpine areas above timberline will disappear during the course of this century, inevitably and really under any of these climate scenarios. Now, we can't say that all the species that occur in those habitats will become extinct, because that some of them occur in rocky places, many of the timberlines are false timberlines and so forth, but it's certainly going to have a drastic effect on one whole life zone in the United States. And I would suggest, and I know some here and elsewhere in the state are working on it, I would suggest that it's very important to get into more and more serious and refined modeling of the impact of climate change, global warming, on many of the natural and artificial communities in California sometime before you hit 60 or 70 million people here. Coral bleaching in the Pacific is associated with the same kinds of effects. You can see here how it's been going up during the same period of time. This is an article in the second issue of Nature in January 2004, which estimates rather more drastically than many people would the percentage of species lost by the middle of this century in the eyes of the authors in those different communities. And notice scrubland, it's about just under 30% of all the species lost. Temperate mixed forest, just under 20%, and so forth. These are sobering facts and they're well worth considering. What they boil down to is that with all those additional factors, two-thirds of all the species becoming extinct during the course of this century could be a conservative estimate. And as I've mentioned a couple of times already, the existence of most lost species will never be known to us. What can we do about it? We can explore and learn about species while they're there. We can learn more about them and about the relationships between them. We can bring that information to the public in printed and electronic forms, because people being informed about organisms will not only be able to deal with them more intentionally, more successfully, but they will actually care about them. They'll get more attached to them. They'll be more interested in them. They'll have a better idea of why they're important to them. We can set aside parks and reserves as one kind of strategy, but again, note that although that alleviates the factor of habitat destruction, it doesn't alleviate the factor necessarily of selective gathering. Certainly doesn't do anything for climate change or for alien invasive species. So we have to be guarding biological diversity in many ways simultaneously. conserving plant diversity in the greenhouse is relatively cost effective, or out in botanical gardens. And of the estimated 300,000 species of plants in the world, about 100,000 are already in a botanical garden somewhere. So about 1 in 3 plant species is already there, although many of those samples are not genetically very good. And you can do the same for animals if the animals are charismatic enough and important to us, and regardless of the fact that it could be a good deal more expensive, if we see it as being worthwhile, we can save a fair number of animals in that way and breed them in captivity. Cute little rascal. We also need education. Here's a Missouri Botanical Garden activity training people associated with parks in Peru about plant census and identification. It's the kind of activity that needs to go on all over the world in terms of being able to identify organisms. And of course, the field courses and the organism oriented courses here tend to produce people who can fill a real niche in many kinds of occupations later, because if you can't recognize them and work with them, you can't do anything else with them either. Bringing young people into an appreciation of biological diversity is one of the most important keys in bringing young people into a situation where they will become caring and informed adults. The ages 4 to 9 are particularly sensitive ages for getting people involved in and excited about nature. And anything that you can do to encourage that in your individual lives or collectively is going to make a huge difference. And if you think of it in terms of the broader picture of sustainability, that kind of interest in nature is what's likely to drive it. A word about the situation of the United States. With 4.5% of the world's population, we have about 25% of the world's economy and about 30% of the world's scientists and engineers. Whereas all the less developed countries in the world taken together, 82% of the world's population, have 20% of the world's economy and 10% of the scientific output. 4.5 and 25 in the first two lines means that whether we recognize it or not, we depend on countries all over the world for our flourishing and high consumption kind of existence. And even if we were to be more conservative in our actions in the U.S. and in our activities, we would still be very dependent on other countries for lots of things that we need or think we need. And yet other countries are very often not operating well. It's remarkable that among the industrialized countries in the world, the United States, which depends on others more than any other country in the world, puts out the least amount per capita in international development assistance, and that always seems to be the factor that is able to be dispensed with whenever the budget gets tight. The Rio Declaration at the Earth Summit said eradicating poverty and reducing disparities in living standards are essential to achieve sustainable development and meet the needs of the majority of people. The United States cannot survive as a rich, prosperous, high consumption, lousy technology, polluting technology country in a world in which such a high proportion of people are living under such awful conditions. These women in the Western Ghats in India are being taught about how to process amla, an herb there that's a very important herb in India, that to process it on the spot after they gather it so that they get more value in it when it's sold to middlemen than they would normally if they just go out and gather and sell off sacks of it. That's the kind of thing that we need to do in order to reverse the world situation. And obviously it's only done a few people, a few places, specific places at a time. We at the Missouri Botanical Garden are working with this school in rural Peru, teaching the kids how to grow tomatoes and grow other kinds of foodstuffs and all. It seems kind of really wacky to be down teaching Peruvian children how to grow tomatoes, but believe me, they don't do it as a regular part of their lives in lots of the country, and this can make an enormous difference both in their levels of nutrition and in their standard of living and in the options that become available to them. In order to preserve biological diversity or deal with this problem, and you will have noticed that I'm going to expanding circles here, we have to deal with the whole question of sustainability. There's no such thing as preserving biodiversity in a non-sustainable world. It's just a non-starter. There's no room for it to be preserved in. Everything about sustainability is about making choices. So here, for example, choices about the pollution, about the amount of pollution we allow these plants to put out, choices about the amount of carbon dioxide in them and all. You know, it's sort of, we know we're killing ourselves, but we're making so much money and have so many people employed that it's necessary to go on doing it. It's really ironic that the EPA, following a lot of testing and thinking, has put out air pollution standards, and every time they come to bear on cities, I realize California is like paradise in this respect, every time they come to bear on cities in most of the country, they say, we've got to avoid these standards and get around them some way, whereas what they ought to be saying is, it's time for us to clean up our act. There are lots of ways that sustainability can be approached on an individual basis, and lots of ways that sustainability can be approached on a collective basis. One of the most heartening things about the whole situation, this very broad situation that I'm discussing, is that so many people are making choices about sustainability because they think they're right, or because they think it's a better way to live or a better thing to do, as, for example, using fisheries and other marine foods that can be obtained on a sustainable basis. Here's kind of an ironic story. I don't know what the situation is in California, but in St. Louis, we succeeded in being able to put in no flush urinals, which are completely efficient and odor free if you install them right. We had to work with the planning commission and the people that give permits for about a year to get them, but within about a month, they were ruled illegal in building projects in St. Louis simply because the plumbing trades didn't want to give up that much business. Each one of those toilets, each one of these no flush urinals saves 40,000 to 70,000 gallons of water a year. And think of what that means in terms of global consumption of water. It was very impressive to hear some of the activities of the architecture school with respect to green architecture. There are so many things that can be done there. They can be so imaginative. But we're going to have a vision. We're going to have better building codes. We're going to have to be willing to go into the future much more strongly and imaginatively than we've gone into the past. And every bit of us, every segment of a university community, every segment of society needs to be challenged in order to get there. I think if I were going to summarize, I'll now summarize what I think are the most important actions for individuals. Promoting international understanding is of supreme, very high importance, because if we don't understand the plight of people around the world, if we don't understand how anybody else lives around the world, if we don't get out there and get to know them, we have no chance whatever of acting in ways that will tend to improve their lives or being generous contributors to their ability to attain sustainability, although that's very much in our own interest. That's where we get a lot of our own products and a lot of our own wealth, the great majority of it, in fact, as I've just demonstrated. But basically, it has more to do with more to do than just those economic facts. It has to do with love. You can't possibly love people who are starving in a unique and specific way in, say, Burma. But on the other hand, you can certainly understand and deal with their situation and regard it as a moral and ethical obligation to try to do something about it, just as it is economically sensible. it becomes the same kind of a dilemma, but on a global basis, that we have with discrimination in individual localities in the United States. It's not only wrong and immoral, it doesn't work. It's economically stupid. We can learn. It's extremely important to learn, because if you're going to try to say anything about the environment or the interactions between all of these things, you have to be giving accurate appraisals. The only way you can learn effectively in these fields is by doing, very much the Cal Poly style. And then once you have learned, you have to act in practical ways in your own life and in political ways in trying to get the various levels of politics that affect your environment and your chance at sustainability to change in the direction that you've learned and believe to be true. And you have to vote. You know, a lot of people have said that in certain elections there are dreadful candidates, dreadful choices to be made. And it has, in part, a kind of a very easy explanation. And it's this: no one votes in the primaries. If you have 15% people voting in the primaries of the major parties, you're always going to be able to flood the primaries with people calling for extreme candidates. And then when you come up to the election, you're going to find those same candidates there available to vote for. Of course, in California, you can vote for everything. You can vote for which shoe should be tied first, or, as I well remember, heck, you probably have to take full time off your jobs just to learn how to vote here, as far as I can remember. An example, a particularly important example of political action tying this all together was, of course, in the planning of Gaylord Nelson, Senator Nelson, who recently passed away, says his major objective in planning Earth Day 70 was to organize a nationwide public demonstration so large it would finally get the attention of the politicians and force the environmental issue into the political dialogue of the nation. It worked. By the sheer force of its collective action on that one day, the American public forever changed the political landscape respecting environmental issues. One out of 10 people in the United States, 20 million people, were actually physically out at somewhere on Earth Day 1970, signaling by their presence that they cared about these issues. You know where Americans and Poles put the environment right now? Around 12 as important issues that they want to deal with. If you think the environment and sustainability are important, you've got to influence people to care about that. It's not going to happen by magic. In terms of a sustainable campus, it's obviously that Cal Poly is applying sustainability principles, but I think many people I've talked to are a bit frustrated with the difficulty of really moving forward in these fields. The idea of having a sustainability coordinator in facilities planning and capital projects is very, very important. In North Carolina, the governor, by edict, said that there needed to be a sustainability officer at every public facility at the state, and each one of them had to be built according to the principles of sustainability. Maybe the state of California could be inspired to do something even a little more uniform along those lines. These policies, as I say, are difficult to implement aggressively. The Tawa Declaration, signed by President Baker in 2004, put Cal Poly in the company of about 350 other universities that have committed themselves to the adoption of sustainability principles. But what does the Declaration say? This is, of course, the preamble. Impressed by all the kinds of facts that I've been reviewing for you tonight, and noting that those trends are caused by inequitable and unsustainable production and consumption patterns that aggravate poverty in many regions of the world, the signatories agree to the following actions. And what you should be thinking of as you look through these actions is, where is the campus on these different actions? Where should it be? Where could it be? How could it be a real example? Increase awareness, create an institutional culture, educate for environmentally responsible citizenship, foster environmental literacy for all. I'll come back to that one in a minute. Practice institutional ecology. Involve all stakeholders. Collaborate for interdisciplinary approaches. Although there are a number of good inter-school collaborations going on here, and although students sometimes are allowed to go out or encouraged to go out and register in courses in other schools in the university, a lot more of that in this wonderful diverse campus could be a great asset. Enhanced capacity of primary and secondary schools, broaden service and outreach nationally and internationally, and maintain the movement. Many units on campus are strong advocates of sustainability, and we've heard from two of them earlier this evening. The development of the campus itself, in as rigidly or as strongly or as aggressively as you could, should become a model of sustainability, which could inspire many people in this beautiful Central Coast area to follow suit. And research activities or tests or practical testing, much of which you have going on, and a lot of this is going on in agriculture and land use here, which is really inspirational, should be carried out to find new modes and models of sustainability. But now think about this. What are the responsibilities of a university to its students? Most of you graduating now will see one-third more people in the world, more pollution, a massive loss of biodiversity, accelerated global warming, worldwide water shortages and food shortages, and you'll have to make important decisions on those, both for the places that you live, for other places in the world, for the government, and for the corporations or concerns that you're working with. So the question that I want to ask is, can anyone in any discipline be considered properly educated who doesn't understand the basic principles of environmental science? Will they be able to function intelligently as citizens or members of society or of their profession? And the last point, of course, I made with tongue in cheek, can we just leave environmental education to the media and chance accumulation of information later in life? Well, finally, should we be optimists or pessimists? It all depends on what each and every one of us does. Gandhi put it very well when he said, "The world provides enough to satisfy every man's need, but not everyone's greed." So this is my idea of what you should do. That's Princess, one of the, a panda that I met in Western Sichuan. I look happy. The panda, I'm not quite sure. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Sure, I'll be glad to take some questions or comments if you like. But I can't see the audience very well. Hearing none. I really can't see. Somebody else probably from a different angle could probably see the people better. I can't. Ah, yeah.
I have a question for you. What role do you think biotechnology has in a sustainable future?
The question is, what role do I think biotechnology has in a sustainable future? There are so many problems involved that people are busy working out the conditions under which biotechnology should be used. it's obvious that for medicines, people regard biotechnology as fine and can change anything in any way that you want, basically, because you're saving lives. In other applications, because of the social and economic and distributional and other many other kinds of problems, we're still working out the ways to do it and the ways that will be approved and appreciated by a majority of people. So I think I believe it will play a major role, but I believe there are very major steps in advancing our understanding that will have to go on in all the many parts of biotechnology and, for that matter, nanotechnology before it really lives up to its very considerable promise.
Hey, I'm a plant guy, as some of you know, Charlie Blair here. Anyway, I want to make a great plea. There is a superb opportunity coming up this summer in Chico. The Botany 2006 conference is going to be in Chico. They're particularly for educators. There's a one for education, but I think education in plant science and basic plant is sadly lacking. And this would be an opportunity for some of our teachers to go for it. Just go to www.botany.org and you'll get there.
Good idea.
Could we have speakers maybe come forth to the bottom of the stairs so I can get the microphones to them? We have a questioner here. He was first.
I don't think I've ever seen so many Cal Poly deans in one place at one time in the time I've been here. So it seems like a good opportunity to address this question you asked, which was, can anyone in any discipline be considered properly educated who does not have a broad understanding of environmental issues? And at Cal Poly, we do not have a required course of any kind in environmental studies or environmental technology. Maybe it's time to have one. In fact, I had I teach in environmental engineering, and we had a course that we teach in water pollution dropped by the General Education Committee for qualifying for an elective in a technology elective. So maybe it's time to do that.
Well, I might just add to what I said that, as some of you may know, the University of Georgia has such a requirement. And since the University of Georgia sets the requirements for all the other 35 public institutions in the state, all the public institutions in Georgia have a uniform, have an environmental science requirement for graduating as an undergraduate. Those are, you know, worked out by a committee, and they can be different. It's not one course that everybody takes necessarily. It's the sort of thing that would have to be worked out very carefully by a committee and endorsed by the administration. But I think Georgia has proved that it's feasible, and they would be worth studying if anybody here begins to want to figure out how to do that. And I highly recommend it, because I couldn't possibly be more serious about what I said.
I assume that this is not the first time you've addressed a group with this subject. And as you do it so often, how are you able to maintain an optimistic attitude?
Well, actually, I'm going out in a few minutes and shoot myself. No. Usually the other groups were happier, and no. I maintain an optimistic attitude because I think so much depends on what individuals do and can do. I think anybody who believes that the situation will get better because, say, science and technology will solve it all, and we can just have license to get on with what we're doing and soon it'll all be okay through some magic, you know, they're both stupid, bordering on immoral, certainly amoral. But I think individuals, as individuals, we each can contribute an enormous amount. And I know that if I talk to a group like this, I will reach some individuals and they will go out and do a little more or a little better than they would have otherwise. As I said, to me, the world is getting more and more homogeneous, less and less interesting, less and less beautiful, and less healthy. less productive, but at some point it will be arrested, and I'm enough of an optimist to believe that the actions of human beings as their hearts are affected and as their views change will bring that about. You know, an anecdote that I often tell, I once there was a lady in St. Louis, and I talked to her at a cocktail party. She was about 93 years old. This was around 10 or 15 years ago. And I said, well, the first part of it's kind of amusing, so I'll mention that before I get to the serious part. I said, Sadie, you look great. She says, Peter, that's the trouble. I look great, but I'm 93 years old, and actually I feel rotten, but nobody ever lets me go and sit down. But then she said, you know, my parents started bringing us all to Carmel in 1929. And I said, and we went there every year. And I said, oh, Sadie, I can't imagine how beautiful Carmel must have been in 1929. She sort of looked at me incredulously and smiled and said, you know what they said when we got there? They said, you should have seen this place in 1925. It really amounted to something. Think of yourselves as being in Carmel in 1929 and then having the years from 1929 to the present to decide exactly collectively how to develop it, what you can do about your own life, how you can make your own little part of it look good. And you'll have a very realistic view. I mean, in India, there are a million more people every 12 days. In the world at large, the population is growing rapidly. Large numbers of people live in misery. Americans use twice as much energy per capita as they do in the countries of Western Europe. But those are all things that we can do something about one way or the other. So my attitude is, let's try to do it.
First, on behalf of the community of San Luis Obispo, we very much appreciate you coming. My question is more on an economic side. We see the polarization of wealth, the poor getting poorer and the richer getting richer. And as people get poorer, their opportunities, they're kind of forced to buy cheaper cheaper things. As well as I think it's very, our economic ideology, our neoliberalism, is very much for, in our free trade agreements, are very much for the richer people. How do we respond, or how would you recommend us respond to this in the context of your talk?
Learn and vote. I mean, we could hold a rally together, but it's a very serious problem. It's unsustainable in the same sense as everything else that I talked about. And if you think that, if you have that point of view, then the thing to do is learn and vote. Get on with it. We are fortunate enough to live in a democracy.
In St. Louis, you've created a model with bioprospecting in the botanical garden and a biotech center where you explore the wonders of germplasm. And so San Luis obviously is interested in creating a similar situation. And I suppose that is one of the reasons you're here. And another part of that would be the corporate culture, how that's involved in creating that scenario. And since Monsanto has been very instrumental in your success in this field, would you explain how that corporate culture is a good thing?
What's the permaculture?
Corporate culture.
Oh, corporate culture.
As in Monsanto in your case. The garden.
Oh, well, yeah, at several levels. Monsanto, obviously, as an important St. Louis company, supports the St. Louis Symphony, Dance St. Louis, the Opera, the Botanical Garden, Washington University, St. Louis University, and any other institution that you can imagine. So the fact that we're supported by them in part simply means that we're simply means that we're one of the important cultural and scientific organizations in St. Louis. I don't think there's one of them that isn't supported by Monsanto, nor you'd hope that there wouldn't be. What else are you? Tell me the rest. Sorry, but better take back the microphone and tell me the rest of the question. I didn't. I can hear.
Corporate culture is very instrumental in promoting biotechnology and in setting up a biotech center and creating a zoo, like a botanical garden for to keep germplasm. I don't know. And the corporate culture is very important, those corporate dollars. Doing all that.
Oh, I see. You mean, are you saying, are we operating like a corporation or something? Or?
And I'm saying how it affects scientific research.
How it affects what kind of research?
Scientific.
Well, it doesn't affect our scientific research at all. I should correct part of what you said. We don't really have an important center for germplasm. We do have an important activity in bioprospecting, and in fact the agreements that we've had, for example, with Madagascar for some 15 years have been generally regarded as world models of how to do it properly. That's a relatively small activity for us, but we don't have any research in either germ banks or anything like that, or certainly not in genetic engineering. But what I can say about corporations in general is that corporations are creatures of people, and they will respond to what people want just like anything else, because they really all do need licenses to operate. And I use license, of course, in a non-formal sense. So I think the answer is pretty much what you'd say for government, what I've already said for government, that if you disapprove of actions, you work on that. But I would always go back to the word learn. You really have to be well informed. There's an awful lot of assaultative, knee-jerk kind of reactions to different kind of situations that are perfectly legitimate in a democracy, but they could be much better, with more information behind them. And I guess I don't have an awful lot more to say about it. I do have one other thing. Pat reminds me, and thank you for so much work on the lovely PowerPoint. Pat reminds me that we, along with Monsanto and the Washington University, and then later joined by the University of Missouri, Columbia, Purdue, and University of Illinois, have formed something called the Danforth Center for Plant Sciences, which has an independent board, was endowed by the Danforth Foundation and by other agencies, and which is doing fundamental research in plant science to try to improve our understanding of plants and the ways in which we use them, with particular reference to improving conditions in agriculture throughout the world. So in that sense, we are involved in an effort to try to help. As for the improvement of agriculture, my basic premise is that we need to apply all the tools that we possibly can, from microcredit to no-till to integrated pest management and so forth. And I firmly believe that biotechnology has a place in that. Where that individual place is, time will tell, and like everything else, it'll be tested in relation to the whole spectrum.
Hi. I was wondering how familiar you are with the concept of holistic management, and if you are familiar with it, what role...
How what? I couldn't hear the first part.
How familiar you are with the concept of holistic management? Holistic management.
Holistic management of crops?
Of anything, just the concept of holistic management.
Not particularly per se, but from the word, that is what I believe in.
Okay.
I'll buy it. You can explain it to me later, but it sounds good.
I believe, I see no more hands, but I think if anyone, we'll take two more because we're past our limit, and Peter's been very gracious to stay past 9 because we know what time it is in Missouri. I think some of us do. Let's take two more questions, and then I encourage you to follow I wanted to announce one of the gracious things that Dr. Raven and his wife have agreed to do is to continue dialogue with our faculty and our students, to continue to make some recommendations to us, and we're going to be on our committee summarizing tonight's event, making this available on video, and then hoping to have other dialogue around what he's brought to our attention. So the conversation just started tonight, doesn't stop, but we do have to allow him to get some rest. Two more questions. I have one here.
Hi, how you doing? Just some questions. Has there been any effort in maybe the larger community of people who are interested in sustainability to actually define the word sustainability? Because it seems to be a catchphrase that is used in all different disciplines to define a whole host of things that generally comes down to economic sustainability, which doesn't necessarily lead to what I feel maybe you believe sustainability is. And what role in marketing, what role does marketing play in furthering sustainable ideas like development in our country?
Well, sustainable in sustainability in an environmental sense is, I think, maybe the most interesting book I know about it is Kai Lee's Compass and Gyroscope, in which he defines sustainability as continually moving in a particular direction rather than reaching a goal or rather than reaching an absolute. Obviously, you never reach, in environmental terms, perfect sustainability. Now, on the question of sustainability for commercial enterprises, and using the term in an economic sense, on the one, it's kind of different, but on the other hand, it's not really different. There's a very good book on that by Partha, P-A-R-T-H-A, Dasgupta, D-A-S-G-U-P-T-A, who's a very outstanding economist at Cambridge University. And it's called something like Environmental Something and Human Well-Being. And Partha wrote that book, who's a friend, wrote that book because I said to him, why is it that when you see projections of the economy for the next 20 years or for the century or something in Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Economist, you never see a single word about the environment? And yet the environment is changing so rapidly that it must have a profound economic effect, which is one reason that I recommend that you seriously consider the possibility of some kind of undergraduate requirement in that direction. We have to find a better language for integrating environmental sustainability with economic sustainability or political or any other kind of sustainability. But if you define it as moving in a certain direction, as Kai Lee does, then I think that the very breadth of the word has advantages instead of disadvantages. If you want to know when are you fully sustainable, that becomes a kind of an impossible question. It's almost like saying, when are you holy enough or something. Once when I gave a lecture at Grinnell, one of the students there said, well, after I finished lecture like this, I think in a way it was a similar question. Well, how much can I consume?
I guess I have the last question. Thanks for staying a little longer. I'm a teacher. I teach at Paso Robles High School. It's about 30 miles up the coast. And I teach environmental science, and unfortunately it's an elective. But my question is, do you, or for that matter, does anybody in the audience know of a program like the Talwar Declaration for high schools, for middle schools, for elementary schools? Because I think it needs to come down to younger students as well as college age.
I don't think there is one, but I think that's a very good idea. Yeah, go for it.
Let's give a fabulous goodbye to Dr. Raven. Thank you.